I wanted to do something today that would be sort of an easy kind of lesson to fill up both hours for today, and I thought that there's no book of the Bible that's more practical or relevant to the issue of suffering than the book of Job. And so essentially what I want to do today is to use our time this afternoon to take a look at the book of Job and to look at the key lessons I think that we can draw from this book about suffering. So we're just going to get right to it tonight. What I want to do is, first of all, kind of give you an overview of the book. It's a very large book. So in my case, I always like to get the big picture, sort of the overview before we look at something in depth. And then we'll just kind of work our way through the book and try to learn some things about the suffering of Job. So first of all, what kind of book are we reading here? So if you just take your Bible and flip it open to the book of Job and flip through the pages, unless you're using the old King James Version, you should notice that for the most part, the book of Job has a lot of extra white space, just like the book of Psalms. And what that tells us is that it's in poetic form for the most part. The first couple of chapters aren't. The last chapter is not, but the rest of it is very much in the form of poetry, just like the book of Psalms. So one way that you can think about what's going on in the book of Job, since this is in poetic form, or almost musical form, like the book of Psalms, you can think of this as a story that's been turned into a musical. All right, so this is Job the musical that we're going to be reading. It's about a real person. Job is mentioned in the book of Ezekiel as a real person. James refers to him in the New Testament. But it is a story that has been taken and then set to music, more or less. And the reason, of course, is because that's how we best remember things. And this is indeed a story that is worth remembering. As you read the book of Job, it's pretty clear that the time frame of this book is very similar to those chapters of Genesis that deal with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. If you look, for example, in the second and third verses, as it talks about Job's wealth, the way that the Bible indicates his wealth is in terms of his livestock, which is very much what you see in the book of Genesis as it talks about the patriarchs. And so, though we don't know exactly who wrote this book or when this book was written, certainly the time frame of the book is the time frame of the book of Genesis. And then in terms of how this book is structured, 42 chapters, and the kind of big picture of how this book is laid out is as follows. First of all, there's an introductory section. Sometimes, like I know some of you have study Bibles that will have outlines in the front of them or in the notes, it'll refer to this part as the prologue. That's just the word that comes first or before. And that basically is the first three chapters of the book of Job. And then there is a section of a series of dialogues, two-way conversations between Job and three friends who come to comfort him in the midst of his sorrow. And that takes us really through just about chapter 26 of the book. And then we have a series of monologues, that is, a series of speeches by one person, a series by Job, a series by a very unusual figure named Elihu, and then the climax of the book, the Lord himself. And then when we get to chapter 42 and verse 7, there is a conclusion to the book. Sometimes this is referred to as the epilogue. Because, you know, preachers like for things to sound alike, right? So you can say prologue, dialogue, monologue, epilogue. But it just means there's an introduction, there's a conclusion, and in between the two, a series of conversations between Job and his friends, and then a series of speeches given by various individuals, Job, Elihu, and the Lord himself. Now then, as we confront the book of Job, there's some key issues that I think we need to get out on the table that will determine how we interpret and understand this book. So here's the first thing that I really want to emphasize. The book of Job is emphatic that Job himself is a righteous and God-fearing man who has been blessed by God. That's what the very first verse says. There was a man in the land of Uz. That's an area basically usually identified around Edom, down in the southern part of the land of Canaan. A man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless, and upright, one who feared God and turned away from evil. In fact, you could not find a picture-perfect representation of a righteous man according to the Old Testament better than what the Bible says here about Job. When you go to the other books of the Bible that are sometimes called the wisdom books because they talk about wisdom that comes from God, Proverbs 1 verse 7 says, "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom." So when the Bible tells us here that Job is one who fears God, we have the classic wise man. Not the wise man defined by the ways of the world. The wise man defined by God Himself. Whatever else we come to learn about Job, this estimation of Job never changes in the book. And so it is crucial that we get this piece of information out in front of us and keep it in front of us. In verse 8, the Lord Himself says, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil?" Even God Himself says that this is His estimation of Job. This is repeated over in chapter 2 and verse 3. So Job is a righteous man, and he's been blessed by God as a result of this. Now here is a second thing for us to understand in terms of the book of Job. And that is something that in commentaries you will see referred to a lot as the principle of retribution. Now we don't normally talk like that, but here is a phrase that we all use. Whatsoever a man sows, that shall he also reap. That's the principle of retribution. And the idea is, if you are a good person, good things happen to you. And if you are a bad person, bad things happen to you. And there is a very good reason to believe in the idea of the principle of retribution. And that's because this principle is taught over and over and over again in the Bible. For example, I just flipped over to the book of Proverbs, to chapter 3. If you want to read that with me, I'm going to look at verse 33. And just listen to how plainly the principle of retribution is set forth in this passage. Proverbs 3, 33. "The Lord's curse is on the house of the wicked, but He blesses the dwelling of the righteous." Pretty straightforward, right? If you're an evil person, the Lord curses you. If you're a righteous person, the Lord blesses you. And by the way, the fact that Job has thousands of sheep and livestock and camels and a fantastic family, and he's the mightiest man of the East and so forth, is sure evidence that he's a righteous man. Because this passage in Proverbs 3:33 just told us that the Lord blesses those who are righteous, curses those who are wicked. That's the principle of retribution. But the question is this. Is the principle of retribution, is the law of sowing and reaping, the exhaustive explanation for everything that happens? In other words, are there ever any exceptions to this principle? That's the key that we're going to have to deal with in this book. So number one, Job is a righteous man. Number two, the principle of retribution. Here is a third key to understanding what happens in this book. How is it that Job comes into the crosshairs of Satan? And the answer is, the Lord points Satan to Job and wants him to pay attention to Job. Look again at the verse I read just a second ago. In verse 8 of chapter 1, the Lord said to Satan, and by the way, his name in Hebrew means the adversary or the accuser. And so you almost get the idea of a prosecuting attorney looking for someone to prosecute a case against. And it is the Lord who says to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job?" And again in chapter 2, the Lord does the very same thing. What are we to make of this? After all, by pointing out Job to Satan, what ends up happening to Job? Well, he ends up suffering horribly. Those who are very cynically minded look at this story, and here's what they think happened. They think that what basically happened here is a wager. Like if a couple of guys were going to bet on who's going to win the Super Bowl, the New England Patriots or some other team, and so they decide to have a little contest to see who's going to win, except here we're not talking about something like a football game. Here we're talking about the life of a man, an innocent man, a righteous man, a God-fearing man. And for cynically minded people, this is terrible. It looks as if the Lord is playing around with the life of Job. Let me show you a passage, though, that puts this in a different light. And it's one that everybody here knows. Look with me over in Psalm 139. Psalm 139. This is the famous psalm that talks about the great and unmatched power and wisdom and presence of God. That there's nowhere you can go to escape from the presence of God. And then after the psalmist extols the greatness of God, listen to his request in the last two verses. This is Psalm 139. Look at verse 23. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me. Test me. I want you to put me to the test. And know my thoughts, and see if there be any grievous way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. So the reason I'm sitting down today, other than just my inherent laziness, is that I just spent a couple of days in the hospital, and it takes a little bit to get your sea legs back under you, so I'm pacing myself a little bit. And the reason I was in the hospital is because right before we came on this trip up here, I was having some heart palpitations, shortness of breath, no pain, but just kind of weird feelings. And so I went to the doctor, the cardiologist, and they did a stress test. And they called me right before we left and said, well, you could have multiple heart blockages, which is just what everybody wants to hear, you know? And then no sooner did we get up to Maine last Saturday than those palpitations started again, and they just tell you you've got blockages, and really it was scary, so we decided, you know, we can't play around with this. So there's only one way that they can tell for sure whether you have blockages. The stress test is pictures, and it only goes so far. They actually have to stick a thing into your veins and then shoot this dye up in your arteries, and then it gives them a picture and they can see whether you're clear or not. And then of course they come and they give you this form that you have to sign that tells about all the horrible things that can go wrong in this test, right? And so I'm laying there and I got to sign this form that tells me all these horrible things that could happen. And I was very scared and nervous the night before because I don't know what they're going to find. Is this, I mean, my fried chicken days are over, you know? And you know, my wife, I want to be there for her. And if there's a problem, I don't want to, you know, have that handicap me at all. So I will tell you, having a heart cath was not on my list of things I intend to do on my trip to New England. But I'm really glad they tested my heart because I wanted to know what was in my heart. And knowing what was in my heart was the key to my peace. And fortunately, they found out that everything looks fine. It was just shadows on the stress test. So now I know that. And so now I'm much more relieved. And the palpitation should be fairly simple to take care of. It's not a heart disease or anything. Well, the psalmist is saying at the end of Psalm 139, Lord, I'm not sure what's in my heart. And I want to find out, because I want to be right. I want to have peace in your presence, which no one can escape. And there's only one way for me to know that. I need a heart test. I need for you to examine my heart. And there's only one way for that to happen. You've got to try me. And I want you to see that in Psalm 139, it's not like the psalmist is saying, boy, this is sure terrible, and I don't want to have to go through this. Is there any way? He's pleading with God, try me. So now when you go back to the book of Job in the opening chapters, what we're reading here is not some kind of cynical wager over the life of an innocent man. I would suggest to you what we're seeing in Job is, what does it look like for the Lord to try and test one of his servants so that that servant can really know what is in his heart? That doesn't mean it's easy. It doesn't mean it's painless. Any more than my test was just, you know, a walk in the park. But it's crucial and necessary, and it is what anybody would want if they want to be pleasing to God. So I want you to read the story of Job in light of the fact Why does the Lord bring Job to Satan's attention? Just maybe what's happening here is the answer to a prayer like what we see at the end of Psalm 139. Here's the fourth point I want us to understand, and what this book is really about. Now, I said to you a moment ago that there's probably not a book that any of us think of when we think about the issue of suffering more readily than the book of Job. But I will say to you that I don't think it is the most fruitful enterprise to read the book of Job as if this book is going to explain every conceivable reason why we suffer, or to provide the exhaustive answer to the perplexing problem of evil. Now, maybe others find that, and I just can't. But that's not what I see in the book. Instead, I actually see a very explicit question that this book deals with very up front. And that is the question that the Satan, the adversary, the accuser, raises when the Lord says, "Have you considered my servant Job?" Look at chapter 1 and verse 9. "Then Satan answered the Lord and said, 'Does Job fear God for no reason, for nothing?'" In other words, here's what Satan is saying. You say that Job fears you, God. Well, there's only one reason he fears you. Because you've given him a bunch of stuff. But I'll tell you what. Take that stuff away from Job, and he won't fear you anymore. Because he's only in it for what he can get out of you. And so that's why the adversary says in verse 10, "Have you not put a hedge around him on his house? And all he has on every side, you have blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will curse you to your face." Take away his stuff, and when Job has nothing, he won't fear you anymore. He only fears you for what he can get out of you. In other words, there's two kinds of people. I heard a writer put it like this. There are consumers and communers. A consumer. What's a consumer? That's a person who goes and buys stuff, right? To get stuff. A consumer is a person who fears God because of what they can get from Him. The goods and services God provides to that person as a consumer. That's what Satan is saying about Job. He's a consumer. He only fears you because he gives you stuff. Versus a communer. To commune. To share. To be united. And that would be a person who fears God, not because of any good that he gets, but because of the God he gets. Because what that person wants is not any extraneous thing. What the person wants is simply God. To commune with God. To be in fellowship with God. They don't fear God just because God promises them little trinkets. They fear God because they want God more than anything else. Consumer or communer. Now think about it. This is the accusation of the accuser. Job is a consumer. Take all this stuff away, he won't fear you anymore. Well, if the heart of Job is going to be tested, there's only one way to test this, isn't there? If the issue is Job only fears God because God gives him stuff, what are you going to have to take away to test that? You have to take away his stuff. And so that's exactly what happens. And as the rest of chapter 1 unfolds, all of those vestiges or exemplifications of wealth and prestige that the book opened up with, Job's children, Job's standing, Job's possessions, one by one, are taken away. And at the end of chapter 1, after this all happens, I want you to notice Job's response. In chapter 1, it says, in verse 20, "Job arose and tore his robe and shaved his head and fell on the ground and worshipped. And he said, 'Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return. The Lord gave, the Lord take it away. Blessed be the name of the Lord.'" Job's stuff has been taken away. Has he stopped fearing God? What's the answer? No, he still fears God. Now, it would be a great place for the book to end, right? One chapter, and that's the end of the story. But the Satan says, "Well, wait a minute. Here's the problem. Yeah, you let me take away his stuff, But you didn't let me touch Job personally. And boy, there is a difference there, isn't there? So Christy's not feeling great this afternoon, so she's staying home. Or maybe she just didn't want to hear me preach anymore. You know, she's already had to hear that a lot on this trip. But so as it turned out, the morning that she had the CAT scan that initially showed her cancer, she lost her job. So when she lost her job that day, we didn't know she had cancer. And I will tell you, we thought that was the worst tragedy in the world when she found out she had lost her job. It was tough for her because she had worked hard all of her life for her job. Until 2 weeks later, when it touched her physically. And that was a completely different experience. It is, isn't it? It's one thing to lose your stuff. But when you lose your health, it's a different matter entirely. And Satan says, no, here's the deal. Job loves you because you're protecting him personally. Verse 4 of chapter 2. Satan answered the Lord and said, skin for skin, all a man has, he will give for his life. But stretch out your hand and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will curse you to his face. So now, what Satan is saying is, Job fears you because you're protecting him physically. Take away his health, and we'll see what happens. And so really what we're going to have to do is take everything away from Job, even his physical health. We don't know exactly what it is that Job is afflicted with. I mean, if we were going to diagnose it, it's hard to say. The description in chapter 2, verse 7, is loathsome sores from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. It puts me to mind of maybe something like some of you maybe have had shingles. And you know what a painful, terrible condition that is. Except something that is, it is so much worse because as the book unfolds, Job talks about things like actually disintegrating in the presence of the people who witness him. Some kind of horrible condition that made Job want to die. That's how serious this is. And if you want to see how it affects Job, look in chapter 3 where he laments. He has this cry of mourning and despair. And basically what he says is this. First of all, I wish I had never been born. Chapter 3, verse 3. Let the day perish on which I was born and the night that said a man is conceived. And then in verse 11 he says, if I had to be born, why couldn't I have died at birth? Verse 11, why did I not die at birth and come out from the womb and expire? And then in verse 20 he says, and if that couldn't happen, why can't I just die now? Verse 20, why is light given to him who is in misery and life to the bitter in soul who long for death, but it comes not? Now remember, Job is a righteous man. And it is the Lord who brings Job to Satan's attention. And while if you are familiar at all with the book of Job, you know how the book ends. We cannot forget that in the moment as Job suffered, this was a terrible misery for him to experience. For someone to be so miserable they wish they could die. And we've got to get that emotional component to what Job is facing in mind so that we can really grasp this book. The testing of the heart is not a pretty thing, even though its results are wonderful. All right, now then. We come to chapter 4, and at this point we are introduced to three friends who are going to begin to talk to Job. And those three friends are named Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. What's going to happen here is a series of speeches between Job and his friends. So the way it'll work is this. Eliphaz speaks, Job responds. Bildad speaks, Job responds. Zophar speaks, Job responds. That's the end of round one. Round two, same thing. Eliphaz, Job, Bildad, Job, Zophar, Job. Round three, you're going to notice, not everybody speaks. Eliphaz speaks and Job, Bildad and then Job. Zophar doesn't speak. And as you go through the book, you see that the speeches become very short here in round three. And that's because as this series of dialogues unfolds, the tension and animosity grows through the book. So when I say around, if some of you are boxing fans, and that makes you think of a boxing match, that's not necessarily inappropriate here. Because in a lot of ways, this becomes a verbal boxing match between Job and his friends. So let's take a look now at some of these exchanges in these dialogues. Eliphaz speaks first. This is in chapter 4. He says in verse 2, "If one ventures a word with you, will you be impatient? Yet who can keep from speaking? Behold, you've instructed many, and you've strengthened the weak hands. Your words have upheld him who was stumbling, and you've made firm the feeble knees." This gives us the idea that Job had been a well-respected, highly regarded spiritual leader in his community. Verse 5, "But now it has come to you, and you are impatient. It touches you, and you are dismayed." And I'll tell you what, over the last couple of years, I've sure been there. It was a lot easier to preach on the problem of suffering before my wife got cancer. But now that it's hit us so close to home, it's difficult. And all those trite pieces of advice I gave to everybody in the past sound ridiculous when people say them to us. Eliphaz says in verse 6, "Is not your fear of God, your confidence in the integrity of your ways, your hope?" But then notice what Eliphaz says in verse 7. "Remember, who that was innocent ever perished? Or where were the upright cut off? As I have seen, those who plow iniquity and sow trouble reap the same." In other words, what principle is Eliphaz giving voice to here? You reap what you sow. It's the principle of retribution. But of course, the underlying assumption of what Eliphaz is saying here is, well, if you're suffering, and we know that the wicked are the ones who suffer, guess what that means about you, Job? He says in chapter 5 and verse 8, "As for me, Job," here's my advice to you, "I would seek God, and to God would I commit my cause." In other words, Job, here's what you ought to do. You ought to turn to the Lord and commit yourself to Him. Except, remember, from the very first verse of the book, what do we know about Job? He's doing that. So here we have the classic confrontation between the idea of the law of sowing and reaping and the reality of Job's situation. If the principle of retribution, you reap what you sow, is always and exhaustively the exclusive answer to every suffering in life, why is it that Job is suffering when the very first verse of this book tells us he was a righteous man, one who feared God and turned away from evil? And so then Job responds to Eliphaz and says, "You know, I know what you're saying, but here's the reality. I'm an innocent person." Look in chapter 6. He says in verse 1, verse 2, "Oh, that my vexation were weighed and all my calamity laid in the balances. For then it would be heavier than the sand of the sea. Therefore my words have been rash." You think that I'm rash? Well, of course I am. Look at what's happened to me. Verse 4, "For the arrows of the Almighty are in me, and my spirit drinks their poison. The terrors of God are arrayed against me." Who does Job think has punished him and afflicted him? He thinks God has. And yet he knows that he's a righteous man. So notice what he says in verse 5. "Does the wild donkey bray when he has grass, or the ox low over his fodder? Can that which is tasteless be eaten without salt? Are there any taste in the juice of the mallow? My appetite refuses to touch them. They are as food that is loathsome to me." So here's what I want you to see is taking place in this book. There is this principle of sowing and reaping that everybody, including Job, believes is the exclusive answer to why we experience the things we do in life. And then there are these three points. The idea that God is just in what He does, the idea that Job is righteous, and the fact of Job's suffering. So any of you ever have any home remodeling done or construction done, and you talk to the carpenter, and the construction guy says, "Okay, There's a triangle. Good, cheap, and fast. You ever heard this spiel? And you can have two, but not three of them. Right? It can be done good, and it can be cheap, but it won't be fast. It can be good and fast, but it won't be cheap. It can be cheap and fast, but it won't be good. Right? So you're going to have to pick two of the three, right? Well, that's what's going on with Job and his friends. We've got these three things here. The justice of God, the righteousness of Job, the suffering of Job. And both Job and his friends think we can only have two of those three because the law of sowing and reaping, we know, answers everything. Now, which one of these are Job's friends willing to question? Job's righteousness, right? They believe God is just, and they see that Job is suffering, so that must mean Job isn't righteous. Which one of them is Job going to question? God's justice. Because he knows that he's righteous. And by the way, we as the reader know it because the first verse tells us that. And he knows he's suffering. He can't deny that. That only leaves one possibility for Job to question, which is the justice of God. And essentially, this triangle of the tension between Job's suffering and Job's righteousness, in view of the belief in God's justice and the principle of retribution, it is this triangle that really dominates the dialogues that take place between Job and his friends. Notice, however, that he wishes in verse 9 that God would just kill him off and be done with him. Now then, in chapter 8, Bildad speaks. And listen to what he says in verse 1, or verse 2. How long will you say these things, and the words of your mouth be a great wind? You're a windbag, Job. Does God pervert justice? Look at the top of the triangle here. Does God pervert justice? So you can see what Bildad's position is clearly staked out. We know that God is just. Verse 4, if your children, remember Job's children die in chapter 1. If your children have sinned against him, he has delivered them into the hand of their what? Their transgression. They got what was coming to them, Job. And you will too unless you repent. Verse 5, if you will seek God and plead with the Almighty for mercy, if you're pure and upright, surely then he will rouse himself. Except, wait a minute. Bildad is saying, Job, if only you were upright, God would take that penalty away. But we already know Job is upright. The first verse told us that. God told us that. God told us that twice. So Bildad thinks there's the principle of sowing and reaping. I know God is just, therefore, Job, you're a sinner. And of course, you can imagine what Job's response is going to be. Look in chapter 9. Verse 2, truly I know that it is so, but how can a man be in the right before God? If one wished to contend with him, one could not answer him once in 1,000 times. In other words, what Job is saying is this, I want to challenge God's justice, the problem is I can't. Because God is so much greater than me, so much mightier than me, his position is so much more lofty than mine, there's no way for me to go to court with him and to show him that this is wrong. And so what Job wants more than anything else in his speeches, and he will say this over and over again, is the chance to see God, to confront God, and to challenge God because of what has happened to him. Notice what he says down in chapter 9 and verse 19. If it is a contest of strength, behold, he is mighty. If it is a matter of justice, who can summon him? Though I am in the right, my own mouth would condemn me. Though I am blameless, he would prove me perverse. Look at verse 22. It is all one, therefore I say, he destroys both the blameless and the wicked. So what Job says is this, God isn't just. Because I know I'm a righteous man, and I know I'm suffering. And so this principle of sowing and reaping isn't working out. Notice what he says down in verse 32. He is not a man, as I am, that I might answer him, that we should come together to trial. There is no arbiter or mediator between us, that he might lay his hand on both of us. Verse 34, let him take his rod away from me, and let my dread of him terrify me, then I would speak without fear of him. In other words, God just has his thumb on me, hold me down. Take that away, and let us meet on equal footing, and then I'll tell him what the truth really is. And so that's Job's response here. to Bildad's claim. Well, if only you would repent, God would accept you back. If only you would be upright, God would be kind to you. Job says, I am upright. And it can only mean, therefore, that God is not. Go to chapter 11, Zophar. Verse 2. Should a multitude of words go unanswered, and a man full of talk be judged right? Should your babble silence men, and when you mock, shall no one shame you? For you say, my doctrine is pure, and I am clean in God's eyes. But oh, that God would speak and open his lips to you, and he would tell you the secrets of wisdom. For he is manifold in understanding. And then look at what he says at the end of verse 11. Know then that God exacts of you less than your guilt deserves. Here's what Zophar says. Job, not only are you suffering because you're wicked, you're not getting nearly enough for what you deserve. If God was really putting it to you like you deserve, it'd be even worse than this. And you're thinking, well, how can it be worse than this? What a great friend Zophar is, right? That's his response. And then Job responds to him in chapter 12, verse 2. Dripping with sarcasm, no doubt you are the people and wisdom will die with you. Boy, if you guys went away, wisdom would just vanish from the earth. He says in verse 4, I am a laughing stock to my friends. I who called to God and he answered me, a just and blameless man, am a laughing stock. May I remind you that when Job says he is a just and blameless man, that isn't just Job's opinion, is it? It is God's opinion from the opening of the book. And you know what Job is saying here? I have followed God all my life, and now I've lost everything, and people laugh at me, and I'm a fool for doing so. I've wasted my life following God. But then in chapter 13, Job says, you know what? Because I know I'm right, I'm not going to be quiet. He says in verse 18, behold, this is 13:18, behold, I prepared my case. I know that I shall be in the right. Who is there who will contend with me? For then I would be silent and die. Only grant me two things. Look at verse 20. Then I will not hide myself from your face. Withdraw your hand far from me, and let not dread of you terrify me. Then call, and I will answer, or let me speak, and you reply to me. What does Job want more than anything else? He wants to see God and talk to him. And he wants God to answer him. That is what Job wants more than anything else. He says in verse 24, why do you hide your face and count me as an enemy? Why are you hiding from me, God? I want to see you and I want to confront you. Then when we come to round two, there is increasing frustration. As Eliphaz and Bildad and Zophar attack Job even more ferociously. And so look in chapter 15, verse 2. Second round begins like this. Eliphaz says, should a wise man answer with windy knowledge and fill his belly with the east wind? So if you lived in that region of the world, you know that to the east of the land of Uz is the Arabian desert. When the wind comes from the east and sweeps off of the Arabian desert, it's very hot. If you've ever lived in California, the Santa Ana winds, similar experience. So in the Bible, when it talks about the east wind, what it's talking about is the hot wind off the desert. So now, not only has Eliphaz said Job is full of air, now he says, you're full of hot air. And I'm tired of hearing all your hot air bloviate about how righteous you are. Verse 4, you are doing away with the fear of God. Except, wait a minute. What did the very first verse tell us? Job was a righteous man, one who fears God. So why is it that his friends are so convinced that Job is doing away with the fear of God? Because the law of sowing and reaping must indicate that. There cannot possibly be any other explanation for why things take place, can there? That's what his friends think. And frankly, it is what Job thinks as well. Well, chapter 16 and verse 2, you can hardly blame Job for saying this. I've heard many such things, miserable comforters are you all. I guess we could all say an amen to that. Verse 3, shall windy words have an end? You're the windbags, Job says. Now, and if you think that sounds like, no, I'm not, you are. Well, I gotta be honest, that's about the level of vitriol here that starts to unfold between Job and his friends. Notice what he says in verse 15. I have sewn sackcloth upon my skin and laid my strength in the dust. This is a poignant verse, verse 16. My face is red with weeping, and on my eyelids is deep darkness. Have you ever cried so much you look just like what Job is describing? Your face is blotchy, red. You have dark rings under your eyes. And he says in verse 17, although there is no violence in my hands and my prayer is pure, I'm suffering and I haven't done anything wrong. And so he says in verse 20, my friends scorned me. My eye pours out tears to God that he would argue the case of a man with God as a son of man does with his neighbor. Why can't I see God and argue with him? Well, Bildad speaks in round 2. Gives a description of the fate of the wicked. He says in verse 2, how long will you hunt for words? Consider that we will speak. Why are we counted as cattle? Why are we stupid in your sight? Verse 5, indeed, the light of the wicked is put out. The flame of his fire does not shine. The light is dark in his tent. So when Bildad gives this long description of the wicked, guess who's who he is describing? He's describing what he thinks he sees in Job because of what Job is going through. Job responds and says in chapter 19, verse 2, how long will you torment me and break me in pieces with words? 10 times you've cast reproach upon me. Are you not ashamed to wrong me? How can you accuse me of these horrible things when I'm not guilty of anything? And then Job complains about the way he's been treated and the fact that he cannot speak to God. He says in chapter 19 and verse 7, behold, I cry out violence, but I'm not answered. I call for help, but there's no justice. He has walled up my way so that I cannot pass. He set darkness upon my path. Job says down in verse 17, my breath is strange to my wife. I'm a stench to the children of my own mother. Even young children despise me. When I rise, they talk against me. And my intimate friends abhor me. Those whom I love have turned away. So everyone has turned away from Job because they believe he is evil. Zophar speaks and responds in chapter 20. He says in verse 4, do you not know this from of old, since man was placed on the earth, that the exulting, the rejoicing of the wicked is short, and the joy of the godless is but for a moment? In other words, what he's saying is, Job, don't you understand, and everybody knows this, that the wicked always end up getting punished. And so therefore you are under the punishment of God. Well, you get the idea here. When we come to round 3, as I said, the speeches are very short. Eliphaz speaks in chapter 22. And he says in verse 2, can a man be profitable to God? Surely he who is wise is profitable to himself. Is it any pleasure to the Almighty if you are in the right? Or is it gain to him if you make your ways blameless? Is it for fear of him that he reproves you? Now I want you to look very carefully at verse 4 in chapter 22, what Eliphaz says here. He says, Job, do you really think that the reason God is reproving you is because you fear him? And guess what the answer is? Absolutely. Absolutely. But Eliphaz doesn't believe it. He thinks the only reason this could be happening to Job is because God hates him, because he's a wicked man, and so God is punishing him as a result. That's Eliphaz's speech. In chapter 23, Job says this in verse 2, today also my complaint is bitter, my hand is heavy on account of my groaning. Oh, that I knew where I might find him, that I might come even to his seat. What does Job want? We've said it many times. He wants to see God and argue his case before him. I would lay my case, verse 4, before him and fill my mouth with arguments. I would know that he would answer me and understand what he would say to me. Would he contend with me in the greatness of his power? No, he would pay attention to me. There an upright man. Remember, who is an upright man? Who in the book is the upright man? Job. There an upright man could argue with him, and I would be acquitted forever by my judge. I want a chance to see God and talk with him, and I want him to talk to me and explain to me what the world is taking place here. Well, Bildad responds, chapter 25. And what he basically says in verse 4 is this. How then can a man be in the right before God? Guess what? We already know there's a man right before God. God told us who it was. Told us twice. Job. See how important that point is? Every time these friends say, who fears God? Who's upright before God? Who's blameless? They're using the very words God himself used to describe Job. Well, that's the series of dialogues that takes place here. And I think, and as an indication of how completely things have broken down, there's not even a speech by Zophar. It's almost as if to say, there's no point in us even talking any further. I got nothing else to say to you. And so now we come to the next section of the book, which are sometimes called the monologue, in which there's not a dialogue so much as they're just simply a series of speeches. And what we'll do now is we'll take our break, and we'll return to those monologues, and then we'll look at the most important one of all, and that is when the Lord speaks.